Welcome to the Minnesota Military Radio Hour, where we bring you information about Minnesota's National Guard, military community, Beyond the Yellow Ribbon program, and Department of Veteran Affairs. Your host is Tom Lyons, the founder and owner of Phalon Partners Limited, a Twin Cities merger and acquisition advisory firm. Tom is also a Vietnam veteran of the United States Air Force and a member of the VFW and American Legion. Now the host of Minnesota Military Radio Hour, Tom Lyons.
Welcome to the Minnesota Military Radio Hour. I'm Tom Lyons. On today's show, we take you to Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941, with a Minnesotan who lived through the opening days of World War II, and we travel to Afghanistan with our United States Special Forces in the days following September 11th, 2001. But first, it's time for Generally Speaking, a weekly message from the Adjutant General of the Minnesota National Guard, Major General Rick Nash.
This week marks the 70th anniversary of the Japanese attack at Pearl Harbor. As Americans, we all share a connection to that day, but as Minnesotans, we have an additional, unique connection. Many people are unaware that Minnesotans fired the first shot against the Japanese at Pearl Harbor on that day. How was this possible? It is a little-known fact the Minnesota National Guard once had a Navy. In 1899, the Minnesota legislature authorized the formation of a naval militia. This Minnesota naval militia had chapters in Bemidji, Crosby, Duluth, and Pine City. When war was declared in 1917, the naval militia was mobilized and shipped off to the Philadelphia Navy Yard to become part of the Greater Navy. But years later, with World War II on the horizon, the naval militia was expanded and called to active service by the U.S. Navy. The St. Paul Naval Unit was sent to San Diego. The ship that the St. Paul unit would train and fight in was the USS Ward, a World War I-era destroyer. A little over 2 hours before the Japanese attack, the USS Ward, which was on duty providing security outside Pearl Harbor, saw a submarine following a supply ship into the entrance of Pearl Harbor. The Ward immediately went into action. The crew, all from Minnesota, fired its first shot at the sub at 6:45 a.m. The first shot missed, but a second shot from her 4-inch gun found the mark. The shell hit the sub's conning tower, and additional depth charges ensured the sub was destroyed. The Ward returned to Pearl Harbor around 8 a.m., and by then, the attack was underway. At that time, the Ward's crew had no way of knowing that they had fired the first shot against the Japanese. The Japanese used five of these subs in their attack at Pearl Harbor. All five were either sunk or captured. There was always some speculation to the story about the Ward, but on August 28, 2002, the story was confirmed. The Midget submarine was finally found, and the hole in the conning tower was right where the crew of the Ward said they hit it. You can see a part of this history by visiting the original 4-inch gun, which fired the first shot on the grounds of the Veterans Service Building in St. Paul. Take a moment this week and remember the sacrifice of those who gave the last full measure of devotion to their nation on that fateful day 70 years ago. Take inspiration from those, like the crew of the Minnesotans serving on the USS Ward, who fought bravely and ultimately secured peace for our state and nation.
Thank you, General Nash. For more information, please go to MinnesotaMilitaryRadioHour.com. Joining us now is retired Colonel Ed Nakasone, who served with the United States Army Reserves for most of his career, and he also is a retired professor of history at Century College in White Bear Lake, Minnesota. Colonel, welcome to the Minnesota Military Radio Hour.
Thank you.
Colonel,
good to be here.
Good to have you. Can you tell us a little bit about your military career, sir?
Well, there's not much to it except that I was drafted on the 10th of August, 1945. And, of course, as you know, the war ended on 15th of August, 1945. Well, by that time, we had quite a few demands for linguists. And having had my Japanese language trained through my parents, as well as through Japanese language schools that we attended after public school, this made us very, very good candidates for the Japanese Military Intelligence Service Language School. And so I came all the way to Minnesota after basic training at Fort McClellan, Alabama, and came over here on December 25, 1945, and enjoyed my experiences here in Minnesota, Fort Snelling, tremendously. And so after that, I stayed in the military and went to University of Hawaii, ROTC, got my commission there, then came up here to Minnesota and continued on my reserve activities. And I was pretty much a reserve officer all throughout the time that I was in the Army. And I finally got out in 1987.
Colonel, you were born and raised in Hawaii, and you were a second-generation Japanese-American called Nisei?
Hai, that's right.
Hai. And what were you doing on December 7th, 1941, around breakfast time?
Well, interestingly, of course, I was all time very interested in the world affairs, reading newspapers, listening to radio, plus the fact that my father was just returning from Japan. In fact, 1 month before Pearl Harbor, he returned to Hawaii. We were very concerned about that. So I was extremely interested in what was going on in the negotiations in Washington, D.C., the Hull, Kurusu, and Nomura affair going on at that time. And so I was there and listening, and I was having breakfast one day. That was December 7th, 1941, looking westward towards the mountains. And here I see beautiful formation of planes coming through Kolokolo Pass, and after that, going in, down and attacking Schofield Barracks. They did not drop any bombs in Schofield Barracks. Then they zoomed up again, and like another beautiful formation came swooping down Wheeler Army Airfield there and started dropping bombs. And what happened is that they had the bombs fall directly upon the planes, and saw the planes go up. I saw the tarmac going up. I saw the hangars going up. I saw all kinds of fire, all kinds of the noise coming from there. We were no more than 3 miles in the Heights area in the town of Waihewa. And so that's how Pearl Harbor greeted me. And I looked over towards Pearl Harbor, 14 miles to the east, and here the big boom, 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 black ACAC fires. Now later on, a plane comes zooming over my home. I see the great big round ball of red ball underneath the plane's wings and on the fuselage. And I ran into the house and said, wake up, everybody. Japan is attacking us. Japan is attacking us. And then I turned on the radio, and the radio was saying, all servicemen return to your bases. All servicemen return to your bases. The Japanese are attacking the service people of Hawaii. And so with this war greeted us, and then I knew exactly that the war was with us. I saw a plane up there, when a plane came through, and it had the cockpit open and the scarf flowing out. And I saw the goggles on the pilot. I saw this pilot. He was no more than 250 feet up in the air. And, in fact, my neighbor yelled and waved at him. I said, no, he's not our friend, and so on. Well, anyway, when he turned out, war greeted us in that fashion. And then that night we had blackout, and all those things became. And then following day I was already digging a bomb shelter under my direction of my father. And this is the way war greeted us. It was, I could see all kinds of planes, dogfighting up in the area, over Schofield Barracks and over towards Eva Army Airfield, Pearl Harbor, and so on. So it was quite a tragic era as far as I'm concerned. It's now 70 years ago that this has happened.
Colonel, it sounds like you can remember that just like it was yesterday, but the attack was only a couple hours, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. But they started at 7:55, and then by 10:30, almost everything was over. So this is the way it was. There are many interesting stories about what went on during that day, but it's some that will probably take a little bit more research to find out exactly what happened to some of these people.
Colonel, we're going to have to take a short break, then we'll come back, and I'd like to talk a little bit more about that. We're speaking with Ed Nakasone, a retired colonel from the United States Army Reserves who was born and raised in Hawaii, on the Minnesota Military Radio Hour right here on Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Minnesota Military Radio Hour. I'm your host, Tom Lyons, and we're speaking with Ed Nakasone, who is a retired colonel from the United States Reserves, a historian and a retired professor of history at Century College in White Bear Lake, Minnesota, and also who grew up in Hawaii and witnessed firsthand the attack on December 7th, 1941. Colonel, the Japanese attack that day was devastating, sank a lot of ships. 8 Navy battleships were damaged, 4 being sunk. A lot of Americans, 2,459 Americans killed and 1,282 wounded. What do you remember after the attack? There must have been a numbness. What was the sense in Hawaii?
Quite a bit of numbness going on with us because we were of Japanese descent. And, of course, the Japanese country was the one that attacked us. And as a result, we didn't know exactly what was going to happen to us. We do know that the air raid, we had air raid wardens by that time, and they were all going around urging us to black out our homes. And this made us very involved in the idea that war is here. Then beyond that, as I told you, we had air raid bomb shelters being created, and our cars, the headlights were all blacked out, the fenders were all blacked out. And it was one whereby we were kind of looked on with some amount of, what's going to happen to these people and so on. And it wasn't the same as it was out in the West Coast. As it turned out, the people of Hawaii were all very trustworthy as far as we were concerned, and they felt that Japanese Americans should be able to work out as Americans, and it worked out fine. So we went on to schools were stopped for about a couple of weeks or a month, and then after went back to schools and went all these. But the wartime stringency was there. Blackout, as I say, was enforced, plus the fact that the military martial law was declared over Hawaii, and we were looked upon as being, well, we're all right, but we just don't trust everybody to the extent that those of us who were of Japanese descent could not work at Pearl Harbor, could not go into Pearl Harbor whatsoever, and the Army would allow us to work in Schofield Barracks and other Army installations, but not the Navy. They would not do that, nor the Marine Corps, and as it turned out, we were treated pretty much all the way around as being good citizens, and that was very, very thankful as far as we were concerned. So beyond that, we were under rationing procedures, etc., and we also had to pick up cans and steel and so on. But it was like being in wartime mainland. That's about what it was. It was not the same as it was with those who were Japanese Americans who were here on the West Coast, and of course they were incarcerated, as we well know, but we were not for the most part incarcerated. Some of the Japanese in Hawaii who were looked upon suspiciously and had been picked up by the FBI and looked upon as being a danger and perhaps espionage agents and so on, they were about 1,200 of them were placed into camps, temporarily had been set up over there, and at least about 500 of them were brought up to the mainland later on to go into their own immigration and naturalization and justice camps here in the mainland. But by and large, those of us of Japanese descent in Hawaii were treated quite well and looked upon as being good American citizens, which we were. And so that it was not that difficult as far as the Hawaiian Japanese were concerned.
We're speaking with Ed Nakasone, retired colonel from the United States Reserve and a historian, and on the Minnesota Military Radio Hour right here on Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130. Colonel, you've written a number of books. One of them is called The Nisei Soldier, and it's a series of essays about how the Nisei, second-generation American-born Japanese, wanted to participate in World War II, and they ultimately did in the 100th and the 442nd. Could you quickly tell us a little bit about those units that really distinguished themselves quite well?
Well, you do mention those that were extremely well known as far as the 100th Infantry Battalion and the 442nd Regimental Combat Team was concerned. But I would like to point out also there was the MIS, Military Intelligence Service people, who served, and I was part of that later on as the occupation phase came into over Japan. But those who served as interpreters, interrogators, as cave flushers, and those who were in the psychological operations affairs, they were exceedingly brave and were very good in bringing an end to the war. General MacArthur says that one of his intelligence generals said that they shortened the war by 2 years, and it's true. But we have a distinct Minnesota connection there because we did have the MIS, first of all, starting in Presidio of San Francisco, California. But when the West Coast Japanese were all pulled out of there and pushed inland, then the school was pushed inland too. But we had a very, very good governor here, Governor Stassen, who opened up Camp Savage. And Camp Savage was an old men's home, old CCC camp, and the Japanese Americans were accepted there, and Savage people were very kind to us. So I must say that after that, we moved on to Fort Snelling, because more than 6,000 of us went through these schools, and we became the eyes and ears for MacArthur and the Marines and the Navy, and even the Chinese and the British forces and Australian forces use interpreters from the from those who graduate. And these were people who had graduated from the camps in various parts of the West Coast and in the interior, Colorado and as far inland as Arkansas, Utah and Idaho and Wyoming. These were all volunteers who went through the Japanese language training, which had for the most part been active here in Minnesota. So Minnesota has a distinct connection to what went on. And I would like people to know about that. The Minnesotans were extremely good, extremely sociable, extremely kind to Japanese Americans during the war and after the war, and even to this day. They have been very, very socially accepting, and we've become melded into the population here, doing extremely well as Americans.
Colonel, one of these Nisei units has a direct connection to the to today's 34th Red Bull Infantry Division. Could
That's
you quickly
correct.
Quickly explain that?
Yes. Please? Well, the 100th Infantry Battalion was a draftee battalion, and they were moved up to Camp McCoy, and from McCoy went on to Camp Shelby, Mississippi, and from there on to African campaign there, and there they joined the 34th Infantry Division, and then 34th Infantry Division became very, very highly regarded by Japanese Americans of the 100th Infantry. To this day, they look upon the 34th Infantry Division as their mama division, and they have in their place a big sign saying the 34th Infantry Red Bull Division in their clubhouse, and they look upon, and to this day, the 100th Infantry Battalion 442nd Regimental Combat Team, which is a reserve outfit now, they do look upon their connection with the 440, with the Red Bull Division as being the mother division that they would like to be connected with, and have been in Iraq, in Afghanistan, along with other places. And they are very, very truly connected to Minnesota and to this area of the Midwest.
Colonel, the 100th Battalion served admirably, as we've said. Mm-hmm. Some of the toughest fighting in World War II, highly decorated, lost a lot of soldiers. And they were referred to as the Purple Heart group. Could you just quickly tell us
about
that?
Yes, yes. They wanted to prove themselves so very, very much. We were under high suspicion as being not being good soldiers, not being trustworthy and so on. And they fought their hearts out. And I remember now both, and then later on the 100th Infantry becomes part of the 442nd. And there were 21 Medals of Honor. This is the most highly highly decorated unit of its size in the U.S. Army. And so they have that distinct honor of being a good fighting outfit, and their motto was go for broke, go as far as you can, and shoot the works all the time. And so this was the way it was with the Japanese Americans. They were very proud of the fact that they were being trusted in doing work with the U.S. Army, and they, to this day they have some very, very good reputation.
And Colonel, one last question. If our listeners want to learn more about the Nisei soldiers, where would they go?
Well, this, the as I've said before, you can look at Wikipedia, you can look at Google, you can look at, well, even my books, The Nisei Soldier. The Nisei Soldier is all over the place, and there have been many, many things that have been written about the Niseis, both in the civilian life and in the military lives and so on. So all you need to do is check on the bibliography of all these big Japanese American books that are out there today. So,
Colonel, I'd like to thank you for your service to our country and for joining us on the program today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Ed Nakasone, retired colonel from the United States Army Reserve and Century College here in Minnesota on the Minnesota Military Radio Hour. Let's visit this week's Support Our Troops Showcase and see how you can support deployed service members and their families this holiday season. Each year, Beyond the Yellow Ribbon sees an incredible outpouring of individuals that want to help. When these inspired individuals call, they most commonly ask, how can I send care packages to deployed service members? Or, how do I connect with my local Yellow Ribbon network? Now the new Make a Difference button can help align those good intentions with actual needs of military families. Located on the homepage of beyondtheyellowribbon.org's website, the button is the first thing visitors see. It will connect individuals with their local family assistance centers, which can answer those common questions at the local level. Additionally, clicking on Make a Difference will connect individuals to the dozens of nonprofit organizations in Minnesota. Teaming up with those organizations and joining holiday efforts already taking place is another great way to help. Individuals are encouraged to join the efforts of the many businesses and volunteer networks currently registered with the Military Family Care Initiative. These committed groups are providing services, discounts, and volunteer time year-round. Thank you to everyone making an effort to support service members and their families this holiday season and for going Beyond the Yellow Ribbon. Beyond the Yellow Ribbon is a comprehensive program that creates awareness, connecting service members and their families with community support, training, services, and resources. To learn how to support military families in your area, find the Make a Difference button and at beyondtheyellowribbon.org. Beyond the Yellow Ribbon, united to bring service members all the way home. Coming up next, we'll travel to Afghanistan with the United States Special Forces in the days following September 11th, 2001. This is the Minnesota Military Radio Hour on Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130. Welcome back to the Minnesota Military Radio Hour. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. In a few minutes, we're going to go travel to Afghanistan with the United States Special Forces in the days after September 11th, 2001. But first, it's time for the Commissioner's Corner, a weekly update from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Now here's Commissioner Larry Shelledo.
In the early morning hours of December 7th, 1941, hundreds of Japanese fighter planes took off from aircraft carriers in the Pacific Ocean. Using broadcasts from Honolulu radio stations to navigate, the planes arrived off the coast of Oahu, Hawaii at 7:55 a.m. For the people of the United States of America, attack on Pearl Harbor marked the first of 1,351 days of war. It mobilized 16 million young Americans to join the armed forces. 300,000 would die in battle, and another 600,000 would become casualties. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, then president, rightly declared that December 7th will be a day that will live in infamy. This coming Wednesday marks the 70th anniversary of the attacks on Pearl Harbor. The Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs and the veterans communities will honor and remember this war, those who fought, and those who paid the ultimate sacrifice. For more information, visit our website at minnesotaveteran.org.
Thank you, Commissioner Shelledo. For more information, please go to minnesotamilitaryradiohour.com. Joining us now is Mike McElhenney, a retired Master Sergeant, Special Forces Green Beret from the United States Army, who currently works for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Mike, welcome to the Minnesota Military Radio Hour.
Thanks, Sam. Glad to be here.
Mike, I want to start with your position. Recently, you took a position with the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. What are you doing there?
Well, currently, I'm the legislative director with the department. I've worked there for about a year. It's a new challenge. I'm very much enjoying it. And I'll tell you, I find a little bit that your military experience in regards to Veterans Affairs, sometimes they're two different things. But nonetheless, I'm enjoying it.
I would imagine your 20 years plus experience in the military gives you some insight into some of the issues that our veterans in Minnesota are experiencing.
Oh, it certainly does. It certainly is something to draw from. It keeps you focused. You know the importance of what you're doing and what you're trying to accomplish. And you can provide a voice for all the veterans. There's 381,000 plus veterans still in the state of Minnesota. And I just enjoy the heck out of being an advocate for them.
Mike, I want to go to your military career, over 21 years in the Army. What prompted you to try to get to become a Green Beret?
Well, Tom, I'll tell you, I started off, I joined the infantry, great place to learn, sort of grow up. I just missed the falling of the wall in Germany. It was my first duty station and had a lot of great leaders during those first 4.5 years in the military. And I'll tell you, two of those leaders went themselves to join Special Forces. So it just seemed to be the direction to go. It was certainly an interesting place to go. You know, when we look back over the last 20 years and all the things that have happened, Panama and Bosnia, the first Gulf War, you know, just different conflicts and actions everywhere. One of the things we did, we had interacted with some special forces soldiers right after Bosnia, and they gave us some training, and I was very intrigued, and I knew that's just the next place I wanted to apply to. And it's interesting I use the word apply because they have a selection process that's fairly difficult, and they refer to it as their application process. So,
so you put in a lot of time training for the Army Special Forces and at the Airborne School.
That's correct.
And became a Green Beret and part of the Special Forces. And I want to ask you, where were you on September 11th, 2001?
Well, it's interesting. When that when the events unfolded on September 11th, our team was actually in Kazakhstan. We're there conducting some regularly scheduled training with infantry airborne units over there. And we, like I imagine many people, tuned in and saw those tragic events unfold. And that region of the world happens to be in our area of operation, and we just knew that the clock was ticking as to when we were going to find ourselves over there.
And I suppose you had just limited information on what actually happened in New York.
Right, very limited information. We did have, you know, overseas television and news channels that we were able to tune into on occasion. We got information from the embassy, and we were always in contact with our home unit. So the big challenge at that point in time was getting back to the United States to repack to go back over there. And that took a few days as all the planes and the clearance issues they had coming into the United States. But once that was cleared up, even, you know, the military was delayed there for a bit. But once that was cleared up, we made it back in and prepared.
So then you went into seclusion and put together your plan for your unit. Tell us about ODA 574. How many men? And
Operational Detachment Alpha 574. It's commonly referred to as an A team. There's typically 12 members on the team. An officer, a warrant officer, and the rest enlisted soldiers, each with different specialties or military occupational specialties.
We're speaking with the retired Master Sergeant Mike McElhenney, a member of our Special Forces Green Beret on the Minnesota Military Radio Hour right here on Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130. Mike, I know that you got back overseas and you were looking for your mission, and I understand that there were a number of folks you were going to possibly escort into Afghanistan, and eventually a little-known diplomat named Hamid Karzai was the person you were to take back into Afghanistan. Can you tell us a little about that historic moment?
Yeah, that's correct, Tom. We, you know, when things were unfolding in the early months, or the early days, rather, after September 11th, we had received the mission that we're going to go in and conduct unconventional warfare. And what that is to link up with the host nation friendly forces, if you will, and conduct insurgent operations against the Taliban. And during that process, there was, you know, the country was kind of a northern region and a southern region. We were the first team to go into southern Afghanistan. And during this whole process, the State Department, among others, is looking for a leader to emerge to combat the regime that's there. Hamid Karzai was one of several. Unfortunately, or fortunately, rather, when I say one of several, there are many choices, and unfortunately, they were getting killed as you know by the hour in reality. And Hamid Karzai was thought to be assassinated at a point in time. We found out a few hours later he was not, and he was the choice that our team and the nation had chosen at that point in time to take in and conduct an insurgency in southern Afghanistan.
And eventually you went back into Afghanistan with him, and he was welcomed by how do you refer to them?
Yeah, you can use that term. I think we're safe there. In certain military circles, they may give us a dirty look for that. But yeah, they are the ones, they're the host nation people that are standing, that stand up and essentially oust the horrible regime or the bad regime, however you want to phrase it. And there was just a handful of them. You know, we were under the impression that we were going to go in with Hamid Karzai and there'd be about 500 combatants or friendly forces, if you will. And we found that there was about 12 when we got there. The next morning, I think there was about 30, and that was about the steady pace for a while. And it was kind of an ebb and flow of building the insurgency. As we had equipment and other things come in, we were able to establish a larger fighting force. The unfortunate thing is trying to control all those people. You know, one day you might have 30, the next day you might have 150. But, you know, when the time came to move, you know, they all sort of reemerged and we were able to be effective.
We're going to have to take a short break. Sergeant, we'll be right back with Sergeant Mike McElhenney and talk about what happened with an 11-man team and Hamid Karzai in Afghanistan in the days following September 11th, 2001 on the Minnesota Military Radio Hour right here on Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Minnesota Military Radio Hour. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. We've been joined today by retired Master Sergeant Mike McElhenney, a Special Forces Green Beret, and who served in Afghanistan in the days following September 11th, 2001. And as we've been discussing, he was part of ODA Team 574, who accompanied Hamid Karzai into Afghanistan shortly after the tragedies in New York. Mike, can you tell us a little bit now? You had how many weeks were you in country, you were trying to help establish the future president's credibility with the Pashtuns?
Yeah, that's correct, Tom. I'd say all in all, I don't have the exact dates memorized, but it was roughly 5 weeks is the time frame we were there. Unfortunately, our time was shortened significantly by a bombing incident. But the time that we spent on the ground, it was our mission to establish credibility for Hamid Karzai. He was one that had been looked upon by numerous nations to be the future leader of Afghanistan. And before that was established internally and locally, we had to establish his credibility. You have to understand that many of the regions in Afghanistan are tribal. They look to the tribal leaders more so than local or any sort of civil leadership or governance. So to establish his credibility, we had to win against the Taliban. The focus and the mission was to oust the Taliban, kill Al-Qaeda and Taliban, and that's what essentially gave him credibility in southern Afghanistan, and that's what brought the people of Afghanistan out of the woodwork, sort of, or so to speak, to support him and build the numbers that were necessary for him to establish that credibility.
So it was up to your 11-man team, along with supply drops and air cover, to help future President Karzai establish that credibility and build a following with the local community.
That is correct, Tom. It's a pretty significant mission. I will tell you that we have good doctrine that sort of that you plan to follow, which will take you step by step through that process. And we're all very well versed in that. I'll tell you, at 5 weeks, things moved fast. In unconventional warfare, there's various phases, and you hope to have as much time as possible in each one of those phases. We didn't have a lot of time. I think the second night we were on the ground, we were getting probed by the Taliban. We weren't prepared necessarily to move into this town of Tarinkaw, which was the capital province of the region. And we found ourselves loading trucks in the middle of the night and heading into this town where we'd received intelligence that the Taliban, they had just been ousted by the local populace because of the credibility that number one, that Karzai was in the country and that he was, you know, there to lead an insurgency against the Taliban. And so that word spread very quickly and unfortunately triggered an ousting of Taliban in this local town, which really upset the Taliban. And they were coming back in force, and they were going to reestablish their presence, essentially. So we found ourselves in the middle of the night rushing to save a town. There were, you know, I don't know exactly how many trucks and personnel coming back into that town, but we found ourselves in a large battle that once that battle had finished, we had won. Karzai had established himself and established credibility in the region.
And Mike, there are some videos that I watched recently. There's four of them, a series about 20 minutes each, and it tells the full story of that battle at Terenkot. And it was much more intense than what you just described. And we'll have a link to the full story of that on the MinnesotaMilitaryRadioHour.com website so people can go and look at that. I'd encourage them to. But you survived that despite overwhelming odds and courtesy of some fantastic air power. And then you moved on to the next objective. And unfortunately, there was a terrible mistake, an accident, that ended the mission, didn't it?
That's correct. The time had come for us to move into and essentially seize Kandahar, which is a big mission. We had a team in south of Kandahar at that point in time. There was some Marines unit that had come in on the west side. And the bigger plan, which was outside of our realm of thinking at that time, was that everyone was going to kind of converge and seize this town. But just prior to that, our last point of, tactical or the last piece of tactical terrain was a bridge north of Kandahar. And we found ourselves again engaged in a long multi-day battle that ended in tragedy. Unfortunately, we had an errant bomb come in. There's lots of bombs going lots of air support. And, I don't want to say it's a matter of time, but unfortunately, sometimes bad things do happen. And we had a bomb come in a little too close, and it killed a couple of our team members. It killed several of our host nation fighters. And it did cause a medevac of the entire team. So at that point in time, we were combat ineffective, and our mission was over.
We're speaking with retired Master Sergeant Mike McElhenney, a Special Forces member of the United States, who was in Afghanistan shortly after September 11, 2001, on the Minnesota Military Radio Hour on News Talk AM 1130. Mike, that accident was devastating both for your team and for many of Karzai's men.
That is correct. It was a significant blast. It killed, possibly 30 or more host nation fighters. Two of my team members were killed. Another American had come in early that morning, who was also killed or died of wounds, actually, on the aircraft. I lost my arm. One of my team members had significant brain damage. He's blind now. There were a lot of tragic wounds. Fortunately, though, we were medevaced out. We did receive care in some of our great military hospitals, Lance Duell, Walter Reed. We received, in my opinion, all the rehabilitation that we needed. And as I look back, I don't have any regrets. I don't think any of my surviving team members have any regrets. We would do it again. It's a significant price to pay, but the military is the strong arm of our foreign policy. That's how it's phrased sometimes. And there are significant risks inherent in that, and we just
Mike, it turned out to be an historic mission, especially for President Karzai, but a very expensive, costly one for his people and for your team. You lost some team members and the rest of you were wounded. Was it worth it?
Tom, yes, it was worth it. You join the military and you have a purpose and you have a function. And when you go to war, sometimes not everyone comes back, but everyone goes to war. I wouldn't say willingly. No one really wants to go to war, I think. It's a scary thing. It's dangerous, and bad things happen. I'll tell you, when you do go, you realize that you could be killed. But you don't think about what happens if you receive tragic injuries. You don't think about, psychological and physical injuries that can occur as a result of that. But when you come back, this was 10 years ago for me that happened. December 5th will be 10 years ago this incident occurred. I don't have any regrets. It was well worth it. I love this country. I love what it has to offer. I love the people. People that know me might think I'm not the most personable guy, But nonetheless, I love them, and I love being here. And I've been to a lot of countries, and I will tell you, this one satisfies me just fine. I love it here, and yeah, I would certainly, if I had to do it again, knowing the outcome, I think I would still do it again.
Mike, we just got some seconds left. You had a reunion with the remaining members of your team recently. How are they doing? Are they coping with it all right?
They're doing well. Everyone is doing well. After the accident, everyone kind of got medevaced essentially to the same place, but then because of injuries, they filtered back to different areas in the country, different specialty hospitals and so forth. So we lost track of each other there for a while. IPCS'd to Minnesota, and I was here the last 6 years of my career, but just recently we did get all get together, and it was great to see everyone again. It's like we weren't away from each other for more than a few minutes. You know, we were razzing each other. It was kind of a healing process, I'd say. It was good to see that some of the guys, Gil Magalinas, he was our intel sergeant on the team, suffered severe head wounds. And the last time I saw him, he was in a very, very bad way. But now he's walking, he's remembering, he's talking, he's doing just fine. And he competes actually a lot in a lot of Wounded Warrior Project sports events and so forth. And a lot of the other guys, Brad, he went on to be a team sergeant. Vaughn went on to be a team sergeant. Ronnie, a lot of them are still doing the same thing, contracting now. So,
Mike, we just got a couple of seconds left. Any final thoughts for our listeners?
Well, the final thought would be, don't forget ever about those folks that are over there and what they're doing for you. And we're all happy to do it, but, you know, it's not over yet, so please don't forget.
Thanks for joining us today, Mike.
Thanks, Tom.
That was retired Master Sergeant Mike McElhenney, a member of our Special Forces Green Beret, and who was a member of the ODA 574 and served so gallantly in Afghanistan along with his team. We're just about out of time. Thanks for listening to this edition of the Minnesota Military Radio Hour. I'd like to thank our guests for joining us this week, Colonel Retired Ed Nakasone and Retired Master Sergeant Mike McElhenney, Commissioner Larry Shelado, the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, and finally, Minnesota's Adjutant General, Major General Rick Nash. Please join us next week as we talk about a Vietnam Silver Star recipient and our 34th Infantry Division Red Bulls. That's next Sunday morning at 7 right here on Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130. I'm Tom Lyons, and I hope that you make a difference in someone's life this week.
You've been listening to the Minnesota Military Radio Hour with host Tom Lyons. Tom is the founder and owner of Phalon Partners Limited, a merger and acquisition advisory firm located in Minneapolis. He's also a Vietnam veteran of the United States Air Force. We hope you found this program to be informative and entertaining. This has been a production of Clear Channel, MinnesotaMilitaryRadioHour.com, the Minnesota National Guard, BeyondTheYellowRibbon.org, and the Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs. Podcasts of this program are available at MinnesotaMilitaryRadioHour.com. Thanks for listening.